Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon. And this allows us to have an actual real-time conversation because we have telephones. And I have the ability to take your calls, hear what you want to talk about, and talk about it. And so if you have questions, this is primarily the format. If you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith, be glad to hear from you. We'll try to answer those questions for you. If you have a difference of opinion, you're welcome to present it. I'd be glad to hear from you about that as well. The number is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. All week I want to be announcing this because it's coming up this weekend on Saturday and Sunday in Las Vegas. And that we have a lot of listeners in the Las Vegas area, but it's been at least a couple of years, maybe 3 years since I've been to Las Vegas. I'm not sure. I used to come fairly often because we do have a lot of listeners there, but for some reason we just haven't had things set up there recently. But that's changing. This weekend I'll be there at two events on Saturday and one on Sunday. And so if you're interested and you're in the area, I know Sunday is Easter Sunday, so that might interfere with some of your plans. But if it does not, I have there's kind of a meet and greet and Q&A at a KKVV radio station in the afternoon Saturday, 2:30 to 4:30 at KKVV. The address is at our website. And then in the evening, just shortly after that, we have a Q&A in a home, a private home, but you're welcome to join us for that. You'll have to probably RSVP to get the address, but that's listed also. And then Sunday in the evening, I think starting around 5, if I'm not mistaken, we have a long evening together in a home church in Las Vegas, and I've been asked to teach on discipleship there. I'm sure we'll have some questions and answers as well. So those are happening this weekend, Saturday and Sunday, if you're in the Las Vegas area. We'd love to see you. It's been a long time. I've got a lot of friends in Las Vegas I haven't seen for a long time, and we look forward to being there. And that's the main announcement. If you want to attend these meetings, all you need to do is go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, and under the tab that says announcements, you'll find all the pertinent information about the time and place and so forth. So we look forward to seeing you guys. Some of you day after tomorrow, some the next day, maybe some of you both days. All right, we're going to talk first of all today to Rez from the San Francisco Bay Area. Rez, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, good afternoon, Steve. Thanks for taking my call. Steve, yesterday I saw a short video of a lion killing a small gazelle, a baby gazelle, and I just asked myself, why is it that everything, you know, on this planet seems to have to suffer, including humans? We suffer. And I realize the mother of that gazelle probably is watching this and is terrified, and so is the gazelle. And I've heard Christians say, well, you know, this is a result of sin entering the world. But I see it more of like everything in this world kind of has like a symbiotic relationship with itself, that it needs something else to survive. And I just wondered what you thought about that.
Well, the question of animal suffering is a subject that C.S. Lewis took up with a whole chapter in his book, The Problem of Pain. And I didn't feel like his answer was very satisfying, but neither did he. He didn't feel like he knew the answer either, but he mused about the subject, and that's the most we can do. One thing we can be pretty sure of is that most animals are at a much lower cerebral level of development than we are, and have don't have the same sophistication that allows suffering to be as excruciating as otherwise. For example, we can anticipate suffering. We can suffer in advance. We can die a thousand deaths as we anticipate something that we're not even suffering yet. And then our suffering, of course, is combined with all kinds of, unanswered questions in our minds and so forth, which a non-rational creature wouldn't be having this additional thing. There certainly is, I assume there is the physical pain involved. Although, of course, in the lower animals, you know, we're not talking about mammals now, but you were talking about mammals, but talking about creatures like, you know, insects and maybe even fish and salamanders and things like that, it's hard to know if they feel any pain or if it's, you know, how much their brain registers those things. When you get up to, you know, reptiles and birds and things like that, they're somewhat more developed. But again, it's hard to know exactly whether they feel very much pain. We can't get inside their skin. I suppose we could get inside an alligator's skin or a python's skin, but it wouldn't be very desirable. But the thing is, we don't know what's in their head. We know that, you know, they avoid death and they avoid injury and they limp when they're injured and things like that, which means it must register to them that there's pain. But it's hard to know exactly, you know, to what degree that is an issue for them. I mean, for example, somebody asked me once on the air, if Adam had never sinned, would it still hurt him if he dropped a big stone on his toe? Now, the question seems to come from the idea that there would be no suffering of any kind if Adam hadn't sinned. And yet, of course, it would hurt. Even if Adam was sinless, it would hurt if he dropped a stone on his toe. And it's a good thing, too, because pain, I mean, we feel pain because we have a nervous system. That nervous system is highly technologically designed by God to register to us when something is happening to us that is injurious. Because if Adam had never sinned, it would still hurt him to put his hand in a fire. And it's a good thing that we have nerves to tell us that such a thing is happening. If you lean on a hot stove, not knowing it's a hot stove, you'll soon find that out. And you'll pull your hand away before it does further damage. They say one thing about leprosy, you know, how lepers often lose appendages and so forth. Some people think that the disease eats those away. From what I've read, it's not the disease. It's the abuse of those appendages because they don't feel any pain in them. That if I whack my knuckles against a door frame as I'm walking through, it hurts. And I, you know, if I do that numerous times and don't feel any pain, eventually I'm doing some serious harm to my fingers. And so, I mean, pain is frankly an alarm system. It's a warning system that there's some danger. There's something damaging taking place. And although being burned, we would call it a negative experience, and especially if we couldn't pull away from it. But we're glad we can feel it so that it doesn't burn us up. Because there are things in the world that would do a serious harm. The feeling of pain is not a result of the fall. And therefore, pain must, in some sense, function in God's plan. And it does, as an alarm system. Now, when an antelope or a gazelle is eaten by a lion, I know, you know, we've all seen the videos of that kind of stuff. And, you know, your heart goes out to the creature. But it's interesting. Although you sometimes see the creature kind of kicking around trying to escape, we don't know to what degree that's simply a survival instinct. What I'm always amazed by is when I see the lion or the cheetah, you know, grabbing the throat of the gazelle or the wildebeest, though they try to get away, they often don't look like they're in much pain. You can't tell. We don't know if they are. I do know this. That God has built into us not only the capacity for pain, but also for being in shock. Sometimes people get their arms suddenly cut off and they don't even feel it for a while because the body goes into shock. In many cases, a serious injury, the first response of the nervous system is to be in shock and not feel anything. It's very possible that God designed it this way with creatures that are to be prey to other creatures, that, you know, these tremendous injuries that would seem so painful to us looking on might be that something they barely feel at all, if at all. I can't say. I'm not arguing this is the case. I'm arguing from ignorance. And that's what we all have, is ignorance. We don't know what's inside an animal's head. But it does appear, in answer to your question, that suffering of some kind is in the original intention that God had for the earth. Not because he's mean, but because, obviously, in many cases, it serves a good purpose. Now, some people think that lions would not be eating impalas if Adam had not sinned, because you know, Paul says that death entered the world through sin. But it's very obvious, both in Romans 5 and 1 Corinthians 15, where Paul says those things, that he's talking about human death. He's, for example, he contrasts, you know, death came by one man, but resurrection of the dead came by another man, Christ. He's talking about human experience of death, because he's talking about resurrection, which is only promised to humans too. If man had not sinned, the Bible indicates he would be eating from the tree of life. It's because man sinned that he was cut off from the tree of life and therefore dies. But if we had not sinned, we would not die. But animals were never given the tree of life. Animals were not made immortal. In fact, we weren't made immortal. We were made conditionally immortal. Adam would live forever if he ate from the tree of life. He could have immortality. If he was cut off from the tree of life, he was mortal, just like an animal was. And therefore, since God made all creatures mortal, then, death was a potential for man, as well as immortality, depending on whether he ate the tree of life or not. But it was inevitable for animals. And therefore, to say that predators and prey were in the original creation before the fall is not to say anything that the Bible would contradict. If we want to say that God would never allow an insect to die, or a mouse to die, or a rabbit to die, if Adam had not sinned, we would soon be waist deep in rabbits and mice and the sky would be full of flies because they are so fecund. They reproduce so much. So it must be that God had in mind for animals to have a life cycle. And man also was created with a life cycle which could be interrupted and conferred with immortality on the condition of eating the tree of life. That's what I understand the Bible to teach. Therefore, we can say that lions eating gazelles probably was in the original plan, probably not a result of the fall. But, you know, the degree of suffering that is involved to the animal, I don't know. I know that there is some. You know, when we see our dogs injure a leg, they limp on it. We know it, they have some pain. But pain, you know, pain up to a certain point is not tormenting. It's annoying, but it becomes tormenting after a certain intensity. And to what degree animals with lower cranial capacity than ourselves can endure the worst of suffering and have it register, we don't know. We don't know. I mean, we are at least at liberty to speculate that these animals that were made to be prey for predators, that they don't suffer very much. Not as much as we would imagine they would. Certainly, if a lion was eating, had grabbed my neck, and I wasn't dead yet, I'm pretty sure I'd be in a lot of pain. But then I've got a lot more mental faculties than an impala has. And it registers much more, on my brain. So, I'm not trying to, make something ugly, beautiful. But I am saying that it may not be as ugly to the animal as it seems to us. We have no way of knowing. But we do know God's good, and we don't know that God ever had in mind a world where cockroaches don't die, or where mosquitoes don't die, or mice never die. And most of them die by owls and hawks and snakes and such, and foxes. So it would appear that unless God wanted the whole world to be overrun with mice, then he intended for them to serve as prey for certain kinds of predators. At least that's my theory. I'm going to stick with that until I know otherwise. Maybe that would bring some light to the subject. Mark from Minnesota. Mark, welcome.
Thank you. Two-part question, and they may be related in the Genesis verse anyway.
Okay.
Who were the sons of God in Genesis 6:2 and Job 1:6 and Job 38:7? And number two is, who was Anak and his sons, the Nephilim, mentioned in Deuteronomy and Numbers?
Yeah. Well, of course, in Job 38:7, it would seem the sons of God must be angels, because it says that they sang for joy when God laid the foundation of the earth, which means they were around before people were. And that being so, in Job 38:7, it probably is also the identity of the sons of God in Job chapter 1 and 2, when the sons of God presented themselves before the Lord. It's probably referring to angelic beings. Now, Job is a standalone book. It's not, as far as we know, no other biblical writer. The writer of Job, as far as we know, didn't write any other books. So we don't know if the sons of God be the same in every book or not. After all, the term sons of God is a very general term. Often it's used, well, in Job, it seems to be used for angels. In the Old Testament, it is sometimes used for Israel. In Hosea chapter 1, for example, talks about them being sons of the living God. In the New Testament, Christians are called sons of God. Beloved, now we are the children, the sons of God. It does not yet appear what we shall be, but we know when he shall appear, we should be like him. So we know that sons of God can refer to people. It can refer to Israel. It can refer to angels. It, of course, refers to Jesus in a unique sense as the Son of God. And for all we know, it may be a term generically for worshipers of God. Now, when it says in Genesis 6 that the sons of God took wives of the daughters of men and so forth, and this led to the corruption of the world, many people believe it's referring to angels. They get this idea from the book of Enoch, which is not a biblical book. It's not an inspired book, but it's a very old book that predates the New Testament. And Christians and Jews both liked the book of Enoch, though none of them included it in their Bibles. But the book of Enoch suggested that the sons of God were angels, and that view kind of passed into Jewish and early Christian thought and still is found among Christians today. However, it doesn't have exactly biblical, support. I mean, it could be so that it's sons of God, but it could be godly people.
Are the sons of God necessarily good? I mean, like 6-2, it sounds like they were evil and became the Nephilim or something.
No, the Nephilim were in the earth in those days, it says, and also after that when the sons of God went into the daughters of men. So the Nephilim were there before and after those marriages, so the Nephilim seem to be independent of that whole story. They were on the earth as well as these marriages taking place on earth. These are a couple of the conditions that existed before the flood, and apparently led to the need for the flood. It's interesting that some people think that the sin was on the part of angels marrying women. However, when God responded to it, he said, "My spirit shall not always strive with man, for he is, dust or whatever." But it's man, not angels, that God was upset with. And so the sons of God sound like they were men. And in, probably more often than not in Scripture, the sons of God is a term that does refer to men. But we don't know for sure. I mean, since Job uses the term of angels, we don't know if any other biblical writers did. What we can say is if it was men, it'd be the godly men. They weren't ungodly until they started defecting. They started choosing women, as it says, based on how beautiful they were. We must assume that previous to that, godly people chose their mates somewhat more on the basis of how godly their mates were. In other words, a godly man wants a godly wife. But if a man says, well, these godly women, they're not as pretty, but there's some pretty pagans over there, I think I'll marry some of them. Well, then that means there's going to be religiously mixed marriage. There's going to be children born who have perhaps a formerly godly father and a never godly mother. And therefore, it's going to break down the generational transmission of righteousness, basically, through generations. Now, it does say the children of these marriages became mighty men of old, and we don't know anything more about them. They were men of renown. We are told the Nephilim were there in the earth at that same time. We're not told that they were related to those marriages at all. The Anakim are so called because they're descended from a giant named Anak. There were certain races of giants, probably the Nephilim were among them, and the Anakim and others. We know that Goliath was a giant from Gath, and his father was a giant, and he had four brothers that were giants. So this is kind of a family trait in some cases. And, even to this day, there are families or even races of people that tend to be not as tall as other races. There are, an awful lot of the Nigerian men I know are quite tall, basket player size. And then there's, of course, some other races I won't mention, but anyone can think of some, where the average height of the people is somewhat shorter than perhaps the average in America. And so there were often perhaps even more extreme differences, at least in the tall ones, back in the days.
Well, it seems like the Nephilim and or Anak and sons of Anak, it just seems like they were evil, because in Joshua it talks about that Joshua got rid of them from the land.
They were really afraid of them. They were definitely evil. Mm-hmm. All the Canaanites were definitely evil, and in fact, all the inhabitants of the world were very evil in the time of the flood. And they weren't all Nephilim, you know. There were Nephilim in the world, but it was the whole world. Everyone down to, except for Noah and his family, were wicked. The thoughts of their hearts were only evil continually. So, you know, he's not describing the Nephilim as more evil than others. But, of course, the Canaanites were extremely wicked, and many of them appear to have been Nephilim, too. Now, the fact that there were Nephilim in Canaan after the flood suggests that you either can't have the Nephilim being the offspring of angels, which offspring would have been destroyed in the flood in Noah's time, because Noah's family were not Nephilim, and everyone else was killed, or else you've got the angels coming down again after the flood and doing the same thing without the Bible mentioning it, so that we now have some more of them showing up in Canaan. I think it's much more reasonable to suggest that the word Nephilim means giants, and that there were different races of giants, some of them even descended from Noah, which is not too strange. All the races of man descended from Noah, and there are some races taller and some shorter than others. I just don't see any need for the intrusion of supernatural elements into this story. I believe that godly people, up until this point, married godly people, and then the time came when they began to break down their principles on that and married people who weren't so godly because of their physical attractiveness. And this, of course, began to break down the line of righteous families in the world, and that caused greater compromise. And God complained about men on the earth at the time and brought the flood to destroy men, not angels.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
All right, well, thank you for your call. Okay, Abraham from South Dakota, you thought we wouldn't get to you. How you doing?
I'm well, thank you, brother. Good evening to you. And, you know, you and I always, every day and every week, we celebrate the resurrection of Christ. But I just want to wish you and your family, everybody there at the Narrow Path, a very, very blessed Easter holiday. So your first caller made me think about Romans 8:21. In what sense did Paul mean that the creation would be delivered from the bondage of corruption? That wasn't really my question today. It's always a challenge to try to ask Steve Gregg a question he hasn't been asked before by 100 other people. But I'll take a stab at it for what it's worth. So two questions unrelated. Luke 24, verse 21. In what sense did whoever those two were on the road to Emmaus say, in what sense did they ask about that it should have been him that redeemed Israel? That's the first question. Second question goes back to Genesis. Would you please speculate on what you think might have been the reason why the lifespans of the people after the flood dropped off? And those are my questions today, brother.
Okay, great. Yeah, let me take the second question first, because I think I can do it maybe more quickly. We do find that before the flood, when the ages of individuals are given, they seem to live very long, well into their 900s, although never to 1,000. We don't have any that lived to be 1,000. The most long-lived person who on record is Methuselah. He lived to be 969, but a large number of people of his descent, of his ancestors, also lived into the 900s. And yet, after the flood, it just drops to less than half, or no, about half that. You find that most of the people after the flood in the first several generations are living to about, you know, 500 and something years. So it's not quite cut in half, but it's radically cut. And then when you get to Abraham 10 generations after the flood, you know, he lives to be 175. And at 100, he's considered to be old. Obviously, there was a trailing off of lifespans. Why this would be, I cannot say with certainty. One theory would be one that has to do with the natural world. Now, there may have been some spiritual reason. Maybe God was, you know, just deciding to cut shorter the lifespans of the people. But one theory that based on nature is that there were factors in the atmosphere, and one in particular that suggests is a water vapor canopy surrounding the edge of our atmosphere, on the outer edge of our atmosphere surrounding the Earth, a canopy of thick water vapor, which was referred to as the waters above the firmament in Genesis 1. And that when the flood came, it says the windows of heaven were opened. And some would suggest, well, this was the pouring down of the waters from that area so that there was no longer that water vapor barrier after the flood. Now, a water vapor barrier would mitigate some of the dangerous radiation and such, like the sun's radiation and even other radiation from space that does cause aging. And therefore, it might be why people didn't age as quickly before the flood and did afterwards. I'm going to take a break, but I'm going to take your second question when we come back. As you know, we have to break at this point and let people know that The Narrow Path is a listener-supported ministry. And if you'd like to help us stay on the air, you can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. You can also donate from the website, though everything there is free. You should check it out. Lots of resources at thenarrowpath.com. I'll be back in 30 seconds.
Small is the gate and narrow is the path that leads to life. We're proud to welcome you to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Steve has nothing to sell you today, but everything to give you. When today's radio show is over, we invite you to visit thenarrowpath.com, where you'll find topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and the archives of all the radio shows. Study, learn, and enjoy. We thank you for supporting the listener-supported Narrow Path with Steve Gregg.
Welcome back to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We're taking your calls for another half hour. Our lines are full, which means, frankly, if you're not on our switchboard, you probably won't be able to call in today. We just won't have enough time. But every day, Monday through Friday, we have an hour of this, and you can always call in when we have lines open. Before the break, we were talking to Abraham from South Dakota, and he had two questions. We talked about one of them, but we have another one. And so, Abraham, would you restate the question about Luke chapter 24, verse 21?
Yes, sir. So, Luke 24, 21, it should have been, he is the one which should have redeemed Israel. In what sense do you think the whoever it was among the two on the road to Emmaus were making that question? Or making that statement, I should
say. About Jesus? What were they saying about Jesus?
Yes, sir. So, yeah, okay. So the two are on the road to Emmaus, and Jesus is walking with them. You know the story better than I do.
Right.
And,
right, so they're referring to Jesus. They're referring to Jesus as the one that they thought would redeem Israel, right? So you're wondering what they meant by redeem Israel?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, well, the Jews, of course, as you know, you're Jewish yourself, but the Jews anticipated the coming of the Messiah, and one thing that they thought he was going to do is something that had never really happened yet, and that was bring the diaspora, that is the scattered Jews all over the world, back to Israel, redeem them, that is, purchase them back from their captivity. They've been in captivity, many of them, since 722 B.C., when the Assyrians conquered the northern kingdom, and the rest of them went into captivity in 586 B.C., when the nation of Judah was carried off into Babylon. And so from that time on, there never has been a time to this very day that that we could say the majority of the Jewish people were in Israel. In Jesus' day, they were not. In Old Testament times, they're not. Today, they're not. The majority of Jews are in countries outside of Israel, and they're in what they call, of course, the diaspora, which is the dispersion. Now, the Jews felt that people like Jeremiah and Ezekiel and Isaiah had predicted that God would bring back the diaspora, and they associated this event with the coming of the Messiah. This would be an accomplishment the Messiah would do for Israel. He'd bring them back so that the Jews didn't live in the foreign lands anymore, but they lived in Israel. And while some people have lived in Israel after the exile, since the time of Zerubbabel, yet they were carried away into exile again in 70 AD. And since that time, only in the last few centuries have there been very many Jews in Israel, and only since 1948 has there been a nation there. So many people feel that this is the beginning of what the Messiah was expected to do, that is, bring the Jews back from the diaspora into the land. This is what many rabbis will tell you is the principal reason for their not receiving Jesus as the Messiah. They have this expectation of the Messiah, and Jesus simply didn't do that. And therefore, they say, we can't recognize him as Messiah. If he had brought Israel, the Jews, back to the land, they would have seen that as the redemption of the nation, the redemption of Israel. Now, the disciples in Jesus' days expected the same thing the Jews of their day felt. And you'll remember that it was only a few days later, actually a few weeks later, that the disciples asked Jesus in Acts 1:6, "Will you at this time restore the kingdom to Israel?" Which was all part of the panoply of what they believed the Messiah would do, that he'd redeem and restore the nation of Israel and establish the kingdom of David there under himself. This is how they understood things, because that's the way the Jews thought the Messiah was going to operate. So when the men on the road to Emmaus were talking about Jesus, not knowing that it was he to whom they were speaking, they're telling him about Jesus, and they're saying, he was crucified, but we thought, before he was crucified, we had thought that he was going to be the one that would redeem Israel. They mean the Messiah, and that's what they thought Messiah would do. Now, of course, the prophets were correct. The Messiah did redeem Israel. The Bible says in Ephesians 1:7, in him we have redemption through his blood, the forgiveness of sins. In 1 Peter, it says that we were redeemed not by corruptible things like silver and gold, but by the precious blood of Christ in 1 Peter 1, about verse 17, maybe, or 18, I'm not sure, maybe 18 or 19. But we are redeemed by Christ. Now, the fact that many of us, not you, but me, I'm not of the nation of Israel. I'm not of the Jewish race. However, you didn't have to be of the Jewish race to be part of Israel. Even in the Old Testament, you didn't have to be. A Gentile could become a part of Israel. He'd just have to get circumcised and become a proselyte or a convert to Judaism, and then he'd be part of Israel too. And that's still true. It's always possible for Gentiles, always was possible for Gentiles to be part of Israel. But Israel in the Old Testament, as you know, was defined by the covenant that God made with them after he brought them out of Egypt and had brought them to Mount Sinai. He made a covenant with them that formed them into the nation of Israel. And even then, he allowed Gentiles to be part of it. But when Jesus came, he made a new covenant, which, according to Jeremiah, was going to come and replace the old covenant. And it did. Jesus came and he replaced the old covenant with a new. Now, just as Israel had been defined by keeping the old covenant in the Old Testament, Israel's now defined by keeping the new covenant. And that means embracing Christ. So, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of Jewish people have received Christ and entered into the new covenant. And they are what the Bible calls the remnant of Israel. But Gentiles have entered in too. So he has redeemed Israel. He didn't bring back the remnant from foreign countries, but the New Testament writers actually, who were almost all Jewish themselves, believed that these prophecies had been rather misunderstood by the rabbis, who had thought it meant bringing the physical Israelites back to, the territory of their promised land. And Paul, for example, taking a verse from Isaiah 10:22, by the way, Isaiah 10:22 says, the remnant, it says, though the children of Israel be as the sand of the seashore, only the remnant will return. Okay, so Isaiah only predicts a remnant will return, and Paul quotes that, though Israel be as the sand of the seashore, only a remnant shall be saved. He understands return to mean be saved, not to return to a geographical plot of land, but to be saved, as Christians are saved, whether they're in Israel or anywhere else. By the way, of course, in the passage of Isaiah, specifically says, a remnant shall return to the mighty God, which is a reference to Jesus. Isaiah 9:6 and 7 refers to him as the mighty God. And so the next chapter talks about how the remnant of Israel will return to the mighty God. That is the Messiah. And so the remnant have the remnant, the faithful remnant of Israel have returned to the mighty God, to the Messiah, that's Jesus, and Gentiles have joined them there, as was always possible at all times in Israel's history.
Hallelujah.
Amen. Great.
Thank you, brother.
Great to hear from you again. Bye now.
Likewise. Thank you. Bye.
All right. Our next caller is Andy from Thailand. Andy, welcome to The Narrow Path again.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call. The day before yesterday, I was listening to 1 and 2 Peter, and I noticed that when he uses Tartarus, he uses it as the Greek mythology, which is people go to Hades, like Luke 10:15, Capernaum will go down to Hades because it's the underworld. And Tartarus, the demigods and the Titans and the Cyclops.
Right. Exactly.
And so in 2 Peter, he's talking about angels, and they wouldn't go to Hades. They would go to Tartarus.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been doing a lot of reading in Greek mythology, and when I go to the New Testament, it's just these flags are all over the place. And
why?
I'm just wondering.
Why is that a problem? Why is that a problem?
Well, I mean, we talked before about gods getting women pregnant and, you know, heroes are born, and we take that literally as if it actually happened.
I don't think gods made women pregnant.
Well, for Jesus,
That's a unique case. That's the case of God becoming a man through the womb of a woman. That's true.
Right, but that's also Greek mythology.
In Greek mythology, Zeus and other gods would come down and have sex with women and procreate children just like men procreate women. They would just happen to be gods. In the Bible, God didn't have any sex with anybody. He just created a living zygote in the womb of a woman by miraculous intervention. That's a very different picture. That's neither here nor there. Let's talk about Tartarus and Hades.
Yeah.
Okay. The New Testament was written in the Greek language. Now, the Greek language existed for a long time before the New Testament was written. And therefore, there were certain words in the Greek language that were part of the vocabulary. To talk about the place where the dead go, if a Christian wanted to talk about that, he could either make up a word out of thin air to use for that, or he could use the existing word in the Greek language for Hades. Now, that wouldn't mean that the New Testament writers believed all the same things about Hades as the Greek philosophers did, but it would mean that there was already a good word in the Greek language for the concept of where dead people go. And just like there's words in English that come from paganism, for example, today is Thursday, but the word Thursday comes from the word Thor, and it from the Norse god Thor, Thor's day. Now, in other words, this word Thursday came from a time when people were honoring Thor, which is pagan. But when I say Thursday, I'm just using it because it's part of the English language. I'm not making any reference to Thor. I'm not engaging in paganistic beliefs. I'm simply using an English word that has come into our use, and it has some pagan origins. Lots of words do, because paganism is in our past, of our culture, and that's when language was formed. Now, when Peter wanted to think of a place where the fallen angels go, and he didn't want to confuse it with Hades, where people go, there was a good word in the Greek language for a place like that. Now, Peter didn't say that there were Titans or Cyclopses there. If he said that, we'd say, well, this guy is influenced by Greek mythology. But he just, no, angels. Angels who sinned are there. He could have made up a new word. Again, you either use the words that are available in your language that convey the ideas that you're trying to communicate, or if you don't like any of them, I guess you can make up new words. But then no one will know what you're talking about. So I don't really see a problem when the New Testament writers use words that were also used in the Greek language before Christianity was around, and which was used in Greek mythology. I mean, Greek mythology was written in the same Greek language in many cases as was the Greek New Testament. So that's not, how would it be different? What would they do if they're going to say every word in the Greek language that had pagan origins? We're just going to refuse to use those words. We're going to make up new words for those things. Well, why should anyone be obliged to do that? I wouldn't.
Well, right. That's a good point. But the way they use it is the Greek mythology. They're not just using it.
No, that's not true. No, it's not even true. Yeah. Not even close. No, Peter doesn't say one thing about titans or demigods or cyclopses. In Greek mythology, Tartarus was the place where those mythological creatures went. In Peter, angels go there. Now, it's not Greek mythology to believe in angels. So how is he using it the same way that the mythology was using it?
Well, Hades is the underworld, so you go down to it, and they refer to it as down to Hades. And Tartarus...
Hades corresponds with the Hebrew word Sheol. The word Sheol was used throughout the entire Old Testament. And Hades is the exact same concept in Greek. So, you know, Sheol, as far as we know, Sheol wasn't borrowed from Greek mythology. Sheol was being used before there was even a Greek language in ancient Hebrew. Mm-hmm. So when the Greek language came along, it had a word for the same thing as what the Hebrew word Sheol means. And you'll find in the Septuagint, when the Hebrew scripture were translated into Greek, the word Sheol is always translated as Hades. And the New Testament writers followed the Septuagint, and they're not following Greek paganism. They're following the Septuagint. They're just using the language that they were born speaking. They're not attaching the same meanings to it.
So in the Greek mythology, Tartarus is a dark pit. And we're saying that it's a coincidence that there's a separate place for angels, that it's also a dark pit, and that Hades is underground. It's the underworld.
To my mind, it's not a very great coincidence. I mean, they got to go somewhere. And if we're picturing them as being put into a prison, below, then, to describe it as a dark pit, I don't care what language you use. You're going to have to, there's a limited number of words you could use for that same concept. I don't see any problem with it. Andy, I know from your posting in our Facebook page that you're very fascinated with arguments against the Bible. I mean, and you seem to accept them rather thoughtlessly. Because I guess you maybe spend time on YouTube or something, and you spend most of your time apparently listening to people who try to undermine your faith in the Bible. All I'm saying is that every time I've seen you post something, it's been of that nature, and it's always been a case where you're not very aware of the facts. You've listened to a YouTube podcast probably, and that person was a propagandist. They didn't know the facts either, or they didn't want you to know them. One thing I need you to know, Andy, is that YouTube is new to the modern world, but propaganda against the Bible is not new to the modern world. Every thought that anti-Bible YouTube bloggers use has been published in print for hundreds of years by critics of the Bible, and biblical scholars have been aware of them and have answered them. Unfortunately, I know you're a relatively new Christian, at least you were when you first began calling me years ago, I think you've spent an awful lot of your time listening to things that are calculated to undermine your faith. And you're welcome to. Christians have freedom to listen to whatever they want to, but they're not very wise, if they want to follow Christ, to listen only to people who are making up propaganda against Christ, when in fact there's not one point of propaganda against Christ that is not answerable. And the reason for that is because Christ is true, and there's no possible argument against the truth which could be valid. So I realize that you're still trying to decide if Christ is true, but you wouldn't have as much trouble deciding that objectively if you didn't spend all your time trying to fill your mind with the arguments of skeptics. Once you know the truth, I mean, once you're strong in the truth, then reading skeptics, I read skeptics too. I love to read atheists and so forth. But then I know enough about what they're talking about from a Christian point of view to know when they're making up garbage. Because I actually have all my life been studying these things, and I recognize garbage when I read it. But a young Christian doesn't. The garbage looks just like the normal food, and sometimes it's more sensational. The garbage is a lot of times sexier than the plain truth. And I would just warn you, because it's a danger that many people may fall into, and I know you have. Is that you're fascinated with listening to arguments against the Bible, every one of which is a flawed argument, But even when I have told you that they are flawed arguments, it's like water off a duck's back. You're so committed to listening to these flawed arguments that there's not too much I can do for you like that. But anyway, I have answered your question today, and I do need to, before I'm out of time, take some more
calls. Thank you so much.
It's always good to hear from you.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
God bless you, Andy. Okay, let's talk to Lisa from Hillsboro, Oregon. Lisa, welcome.
Hi, Steve. I just want to say, I really appreciate you and being able to listen to you and hear your perspective. I'm in the car right now, so I'm just going to ask you my question and then take the answer off the air.
That's fine.
I go to a Church of Christ.
Uh-huh.
And we do, I think I've heard you talk about this, you know, that we do no instruments. We just sing a cappella, and that was how I grew up. And I don't even remember the verse that it was based on, but I just accepted it when I was a child. And then my husband and I ended up going to another church for about 20 years, where there was instruments, and I had thought, well, if they did it in the Old Testament, why would it all of a sudden be a sin in the New Testament? And
right.
Now we're back at the Church of Christ, and I actually just prefer a cappella music because I feel like in the Church of Christ, people know how to sing parts, and I just
Amen.
Think it's prettier. But I don't,
I don't think
that there's anything wrong with instrumental music.
Yeah.
But last night I was at a Bible study at my church, and I was talking. This subject came up just afterwards. We were chatting, and one of the guys made me think of something that I hadn't really considered before, and he was talking about Amos 6:5, and he was saying that in the Old Testament when they had instruments, it wasn't ever commanded, and we don't know that it was even what God preferred, and maybe it was what David just wanted to do. They were saying it was usually always what David said to do, not what God said to do, and then in Amos 6:5, he's saying, who sings idle songs to the sound of the harp, and like David, invent for themselves instruments of music, giving the implication that maybe God wasn't pleased with that. So you could just talk about that. And if you have something on one of your lectures that you specifically talk about this issue, if you could point me that to that as well.
Okay. Yeah, well, you wanted to take it off here. Go ahead. I'll address
okay.
it. Thank you so
okay,
much,
thank you.
Lisa. Yeah. Well, you know, I don't know that I have a lecture on this subject because I don't think it's a big enough subject to devote a whole lecture to. I know that I have addressed it when I've talked about some of the relevant passages about musical instruments. To say that, when they followed David's instructions about music and instruments, well, that's true. Now, of course, not everything David said needs to be followed, and David was a flawed man, although in, Acts chapter 2, Peter does say David was a prophet. So, we don't know whether when David gave these commands to use the instrument of 10 strings and the psaltery and the harp and the loud-sounding cymbals, we don't know if he was speaking prophetically or not, but we don't know that he wasn't. We do know this, the New Testament has 3 times it tells us to sing the Psalms. In Ephesians chapter 4, I'm sorry, chapter 5, verses 19 through 21, we're told to sing the Psalms. There's a parallel passage to that in Colossians chapter 3. And, of course, there's in James chapter 5, a command, is anyone merry, let him sing the Psalms. Now, if we're going to sing the Psalms, James also said we should not just be hearers of the word, but doers of the word. So if we're singing the Psalms, and the Psalms said play skillfully with a instrument of 10 strings and a psaltery and a harp, am I supposed to sing the Psalms but not obey them? Am I supposed to assume the instructions given in the Psalms are not reliable instructions? Aren't they part of the Bible? Aren't they the part of the Bible that the New Testament has quoted more than any other? It seems like they had a great deal of confidence in the Psalms. And now we're told that we're not supposed to obey the Psalms when they tell us to do that, because it was only David. Well, what about the Holy Spirit? Was he involved in that at all? Also, of course, the word psalm itself, which is found in all 3 of those New Testament passages, and it's also the title of the book of Psalms in the Greek Old Testament, is psalmos, which means a poem to be accompanied by stringed instruments. That's specifically the meaning of the word psalm, a poem to be accompanied by stringed instruments. So if we're told we should sing the Psalms, and the great sing the poems that are to be accompanied by stringed instruments. You know, to say, well, that was just David saying to do that. Well, what about Paul saying it and James saying it? How many people have to say it before we realize, well, maybe this is God saying it? You know, how many biblical writers have to confirm it? Now, it is true that in Amos, there's a rebuke to those fat cow women, it says, who sit around and ask him to have bowls of wine brought into them and to be entertained endlessly by instruments of music and so forth. There's no question that the Bible does not, you know, the Bible doesn't ever say the instruments of music are only for good. Alcohol can be for good, but it can be used for bad. Food can be used for good or bad. You can become a glutton. Music can be used for good or bad. But the fact that it is used without criticism throughout Scripture makes it really tenuous for any church to say that it's wrong to use it. Now, in Revelation 14, when John is, you know, seeing the Lamb standing on Mount Zion with his 144,000, says they had there were harpists playing their harps, and they sang, as it were, a new song before the throne. This is Revelation 14 in the first four verses. So if in heaven, or at least the godly, whether they're in heaven or Mount Zion, wherever they are, if they're playing harps and singing, this looks like it's something that God approves of. At least there's not the slightest hint that there's anything wrong going on here in Revelation 14. They're playing harps. Now, I don't play the harp, but a harp is a musical instrument. And if it's okay to play a harp, then how could it be wrong to play any other musical instrument? I just think the whole position that it's wrong to use musical instruments is flawed exegetically and wrong-headed and inconsistent. On the other hand, like yourself, I actually prefer a cappella music. I play musical instruments myself, but if our church had vigorous singers like the Churches of Christ have, who know how to sing, and they know the songs, and they're enthusiastic, and they break up into three-part harmonies and things like that, I'd definitely put the instruments away and just sing a cappella with the group. And I think it'd be a great thing. But to say that just because I like a cappella singing, that it's wrong to have any other kind, namely accompanied by instruments, would simply be taking my own preferences and putting them ahead of the Bible. The Bible simply does not agree with any forbidding of the use of musical instruments. So sometimes the Church of Christ people said, well, if you read Genesis chapter 4, the first musical instruments were invented by descendants of Cain, and Cain was evil. Well, Cain might have been evil. We don't know that his descendants were. You know, just because there's a man who's evil, does that mean that his descendants, like seven generations removed from him, are evil too? We're not told anywhere that the people who invented musical instruments were evil. And to blame somebody or judge somebody by who his great-great-great-great-great-grandfather was is very much against biblical principle. The father shall not be punished for his son's sins, and the son shall not be punished for his father's sins, much less the sins of his great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather. So, I mean, all the arguments used to support non-instrumental mandates frankly, I have a lot of respect for the Churches of Christ. But when I hear those kinds of arguments, it basically undermines my respect for their exegesis, because it just doesn't hold up to biblical scrutiny. Anyway, God bless you. Stay with the a cappella singing. I think it's beautiful. Not a problem to me. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. We are listener-supported. If you'd like to write to us, the address is The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. Let's talk again tomorrow. God bless you.